When you try your best but you don't succeed. When you get what you want but not what you need.
720 WGN, the Matt Bubala Show. Thanks for being with us here as always. So a lot of talk this week about the American Health Care Act, I believe that's what it's called. The effort by the House and President Trump to repeal Obamacare still has to get through the Senate. Might take some time before anything truly happens, if anything happens at all. But there has been a lot of concern, certainly, about the provisions so far put through in this bill that went through the House that narrowly passed by just 4 votes and what it would do to people. And I read a very fascinating article on Friday. It was printed in The Guardian from Adam Gaffney. The headline was Donald Trump's homicidal health care bill will kill some and enrich others. Sometimes the headlines are different from what's actually written by the writer. Let's find out. Adam Gaffney joins us on the phone right now. Hi, Adam. How are you?
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. Thanks for being with us. So Dr. Adam Gaffney, you're a pulmonary and critical care doctor. You're an instructor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. And are you the founder of Physicians for a National Health Program?
I'm not the founder, but I am a member of the board.
Okay. How long has that organization been around?
It has been around, I can't give you the exact year, but since the early 90s.
Okay, so it's had some time on its hands.
It's had some time, and it's done some really good work in terms of keeping, you know, the light alive of universal health care in this country.
Okay, so universal health care, I don't know the whole history of it. I know Hillary Clinton tried really hard when she was first lady to have something like this pass. President Obama spent a lot of his political capital to get something like this pass. I would imagine we could all agree, Adam, that it hasn't been perfect. Obamacare certainly has not been perfect, right? Because I know as a small business owner who has to buy his own insurance ever since I left a big company, my rates have gone through the roof year over year over year. And finally this year, my wife and I replaced the coverage we've had for 10 years that was great coverage to a lower cost coverage that now has outrageous deductibles and things like that just because the costs got so bad. So I know I'm just one little sliver of that pie, but overall, what grade would you have given to the Obamacare as we know it today?
Well, I mean, I think you point out a good point, and I'm sure we're going to get to Trump care at some point.
Oh, yes, we will.
But I think you're right. I mean, the status quo is not good, and this is why this helped allow Trump care to come about. You know, if you have a flawed system, it opens up the door for attack. So, yes. There has been a rise, and you say, in deductibles in recent years. That's been, you know, well established. People are having to pay more and more out of pocket every time they go to the doctor, every time they're hospitalized. And it's not right, and it's not necessary. So, you know, we really believe in something that goes well beyond Obamacare, what we call single-payer universal health care, a program that would cover everybody without the kinds of deductibles you're talking about. And so I think it's fair to say that the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare helped many people. You know, about 20 million people more were insured as a result of it. It left a lot undone, and it left a lot of people behind. And you may be one of those people, you and your family, who are sort of stuck with these extremely high deductibles, extremely high health care bills. So no question that the status quo is not good enough.
The status quo is not good enough, but with what you've seen so far of what the replacement plan is, you would say, I would guess, this is way worse than what we're suffering through right now. If Obamacare is not working perfectly, this is not the solution, is my guess is what you would say.
Well, exactly. I mean, think of it from a medical context. If someone is not doing well, you can do something to make them better or make them do even worse, right? So just because something is not working doesn't mean you can't make it worse. So that's what we're seeing right now. So, you know, what would Trump care do? And just in broad terms, because it does a whole bunch. Well, in many ways, it really keeps intact some of the structure of the Affordable Care Act. And what it does is it simply tweaks it in a major way. Tweak is not the right word. It transforms it in a way that's much less favorable to working class people and much more favorable to very rich people. So let's just go through a couple of those things. So one, it cuts Medicaid. So Medicaid is a program for lower-income people. And the law is going to cut in excess of $800 billion in Medicaid funding over the next decade. And that's going to throw lots of people who currently rely on Medicaid off of insurance. They will become uninsured. 14 million, I believe, was the estimate of the Congressional Budget Office for people losing Medicaid. And then what does it do to the subsidies that many people use to buy plans on the marketplaces, the so-called Obamacare plans? Well, it changes them. It makes them less adequate. It makes them more aggressive. More people are going to have a difficult – many more people are going to have – are going to struggle to actually be able to afford to buy a plan on the marketplace. So it squeezes those plans that are relied upon by more sort of working class people and middle income people. And at the same time, it repeals these various taxes that were in Obamacare. And that money is going to go directly to the very well off. You know, two of the taxes that it repeals only benefit people making more than $200,000 a year. And in fact, the majority of those money is going to go to people even making more. So really what Trump Care is not so much a health care plan as it is a funnel of funds from working class, middle class people to the rich. That's how I view it, at least.
And that's what's being written about a lot. So when you say it cuts taxes and gives it directly to the rich, like, how can it do that, right? It's because under the new plan, there's taxes being paid by the wealthy that they won't pay anymore?
Exactly. So, for instance, there's a tax on investment income that only applies to people making more than $200,000 a year. And I'm just reading off of the most recent Congressional Budget Office estimates, which do not reflect recent changes, but are probably going to be pretty close. And that is going to reduce that will result in $172 billion less being paid by high-income people for that tax alone. There's another Medicare surcharge tax also on high-income people. That is going to reduce their tax burden over the next 10 years by $127 billion. There's a removal of a tax on health insurance companies. That is going to reduce their taxes by $145 billion. The medical device makers are going to have a tax reduction of $20 billion. Even the tanning salons are going to see $600 million, pretty minor. But the overall point here is that there's major tax cuts for corporations, healthcare corporations, and for the rich, on the one hand. On the other hand, there's cuts in benefits for most everybody else. So I think if you look at the numbers, it's hard to kind of avoid the conclusion that this is, in fact, about helping well-off people.
What I don't understand, I guess, because I haven't read it all, like many congressmen, is that how does a cut in investment income tax on those earning over $200,000 fit into the American Health Care Act? Why is that? Is there a reason that's in there, or they just snuck that in there because they're doing all this at once? I don't. Is that
no,
related somehow to medical?
Because those taxes were created by the Affordable Care Act. So
okay, so those were created to help fund what was going on. So
correct.
So we added taxes to the very wealthy to help fund this in the first place, and now they're stripping them away.
Correct. And we also added taxes to healthcare corporations with the understanding that they were going to benefit from the Affordable Care Act in the sense that they would be getting more paying customers. So, you know, that was part of the sort of exchange. You know, the insurance company is going to have more people buying insurance because they're getting subsidized, so we'll tax them and to sort of even things out. So, yes.
So it's been a lot of tax breaks then compared to what we have now, and the savings from that, or the less income that the government will have, is being taken where from? Mostly from Medicaid, we're reading, and where else?
You know, Medicaid is the biggest one. The CBO, the latest estimate was $839 billion cut over the next 10 years. There's also going to be some reduced spending on the subsidies. So again, these are the subsidies you get to buy insurance plans on the marketplaces. They are not going away. They're being replaced with tax credits, but in reality, it's all tax credits. It's really the same thing that we're talking about. They're just going to not be as generous. Finally, the law also does away with cost-sharing subsidies. These have been in the news a lot. There's a lawsuit going on that was actually started during the Obama era. In any event, this would get rid of cost-sharing subsidies. Cost-sharing subsidies basically lower your deductibles if you're buying plans on the marketplace exchanges. So, yeah, I mean, there's cuts elsewhere. There's a whole bunch of other more minor provisions. There's some cuts to public health spending. there's a cut to, you know, Planned Parenthood for 1 year. But overall, the big cuts are going to be in Medicaid and in the subsidies.
And what we've been reading is now it'll knock about 28 million people or so off of insurance. Is that true? Is that accurate? Are a lot fewer people going to be insured then under this plan if it were to pass through the Senate?
That is the estimate of the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, which, you know, under law is required to produce these estimates of legislation. That was the estimate for both the first and the second version of the AHCA. We do not yet have the CBO estimate for the current version. That is expected next week. In my mind, it's hard to imagine that the number is going to be enormously different. It might be somewhat different. It might be some more. I've heard people, some people say that the newest version will insure more. I've heard some people say will insure less. It's hard to know, but I don't think the number is going to change all that much, if only because from the Medicaid perspective, this is the same as the last version, and that we were looking at 14 million people losing their insurance. But yes, 24 million is the latest estimate of the CBO. In terms of the number of people who will lose insurance.
Now, if one of the congressional leaders of the Republican Party or President Trump was on the phone, they would likely say that this is a good bill. This is going to benefit, I've heard the term, all Americans, that it's going to be better, that we're getting out from under Obamacare. Is there a way that you can see that light that they're selling? Is that a possible way to spin this, or can you see no way other than people earning over $200,000 a year that this actually benefits people?
There might be a segment of the population that it helps monetarily. If you're young and of sort of middle income and healthy, then you might get a bigger subsidy than you would have had or see a lower premium. There may be a relatively small segment of the population that benefits. It will be bad for people who are sick. It will be bad for people who are on the older end of the spectrum. It will be bad for people who are poor. Yes, I mean, they're over. You know, if you think about it sort of simply, you can't get more with less money, right? So they're taking money away from health care, and it's going into tax cuts. So overall, there's going to be a reduction in people's health care. You can't have more people insured or more people better insured if you're spending less money on it. And that's what this bill does. If you're giving people less money to buy insurance plans and giving and cutting funding by Medicaid by 25%, the health care is going to go down. It's not really rocket science. Overall, I think the primary beneficiaries of this bill are going to be the wealthy. And I don't think you can look at the math and come to any other conclusion.
We're speaking with Dr. Adam Gaffney. He's an instructor in medicine at Harvard University Medical School. He is a member of the Board of Physicians for a National Health Program, PNHP.org. We'll get into that in a minute. His blog is at theprogressivephysician.net. Let's find out next about pre-existing conditions. A lot of talk about those with this new bill that was passed. And also the single-payer system. Dr. Gaffney is a supporter of the single-payer system. Let's find out what that's all about and if it could work here in the States. That's next. Matt Bubala with you, 720 WGN.
Could it be? Lights will guide you home and ignite your bones, and I will try to fix you.
It's the Matt Bubala Show on 720 WGN, speaking with Dr. Adam Gaffney of the Physicians for a National Health Program Organization. He's an instructor in medicine at Harvard University, PNHP.org, for Physicians for a National Health Program. We'll get into that in a minute. His blog is at theprogressivephysician.net. Just a quick moment, Dr. Gaffney, on pre-existing conditions. We're hearing that they're not going to be covered in the same way that they are, and B, there's been a lot written about all these new pre-existing conditions, like a cesarean section or a sexual assault. Can you explain what we're reading about that?
Right. So, you know, one of the things that Obamacare did was it prohibited insurance companies from A, denying insurance to people who have certain medical conditions, B, from charging people different premiums based on their medical conditions, And C, it required insurers to provide 10 essential health benefits, things like doctors, hospitals, prescription drugs, maternity care, and so forth. It did those three things. And from a conservative perspective, those are not good ideas. Many conservatives believe that health insurance should reflect how much health care you're getting. So if you need a lot of health care, you should pay more. If you have a pre-existing condition, why shouldn't you have to pay more? The same way, you know, you paid more if you wanted to buy a faster car. That's essentially the libertarian ethos on this issue. And so the original version of the AHCA didn't really do much about that. And that's when you saw all of the people in the House Freedom Caucus, the harder right conservatives, actually reject this bill. And that contributed to the failure of version 1.0 of Trump Care. Then what happened was that a compromise was made. Something called the MacArthur Amendment was proposed and included in the bill. And what that did is it gave states the option to not have community rating. That would allow insurers to base their premiums on people's pre-existing conditions. It also would allow insurers to not necessarily cover all the essential health benefits for states to decide what those health benefits are. And so theoretically, although they'll say, oh, we still have protections for pre-existing conditions, insurance companies can't refuse to cover you if you have a pre-existing condition, that's true, but the insurance companies will be able to charge you more for your pre-existing conditions. So at some point, it becomes sort of meaningless. You know, if I have a serious medical condition and the premium's $20,000, $30,000, $50,000, sure, I have the option of buying it, but can I afford it? Now, there are these high-risk pools they want to set up that would theoretically alleviate this issue. Most people think that it would not take care of the problem. But that's exactly right. And what a pre-existing condition would be really up to the insurance company. So sure, it could say diabetes, it could say cancer, it could say, all the sorts of things that you're talking about. That would really be the prerogative of the insurance company. The same way that a car company can say, well, we're going to charge you higher because you got into an accident last year. Most of us don't have a big problem with it when it comes to a car insurance, but health is something different. Many of us think of health as, a human right, and that we shouldn't be punishing people because of their whatever sicknesses or illnesses they happen to have. And so this is a big issue. And this, came up with Jimmy Kimmel's very emotional late night, monologue about this that got a lot of attention and sort of went viral on the internet. I think it speaks to a very intrinsic human sentiment. And I think that the Republican side of this, well, why shouldn't you have to pay more if you're sick, is actually very unpopular. I really think very few people actually believe that. And so this got a lot of attention, as you said. It attracted a lot of criticism, and it's, very unpopular.
Well, and it's very interesting, the car analogy is a little tough because when I'm driving a car, I have a modicum of control over it. If I have type 1 diabetes I developed as a child or as an adult, that's not because I was drinking sugar my whole life or doing a bunch of bad things. It's because I had that condition. I mean, there's a lot of genetic or otherwise conditions that there's nothing we know of necessarily that we can do about. So that does seem unfair. Now, if it was somebody who has emphysema because they've smoked a pack a day their whole life, I think there would be less, fight back about whether or not they could be charged more and things like that. But this covers such a broad spectrum of just, it's a and it makes sense, right? In the end, you're going to cost more, you're going to have to spend more, but it does seem inherently unfair that the sicker, the people who have a condition that need the care more, could be priced out of it because they can't afford it. Are there any, I know you said they're trying to set up these risk pools and they'll argue this will help and other people will say, no, it won't. As it stands right now, if there weren't risk pools, if I have diabetes and I just have to go buy insurance, is there a limit to how much they can upcharge my premium or is that just up to the insurance company?
You mean, currently they can't charge you more.
Under Trump care, diabetes. Under Trump
and
care, if that
I
goes
would
through.
Say, I know what you're saying about fault and non-fault. I mean, it's a separate issue. I personally don't think that fault should actually factor into it that much. I think people, make different decisions for different reasons. I think a lot of these things are very complicated. I personally, again, think that we should simply, it's bad enough to be in bad health. I don't think you need the additional punishment of having to pay for it. But putting that aside for a moment.
Sure.
No, I don't think there's any limit to how much they could charge. I think that'll be up to the insurance company. I haven't heard of any limit. There is a limit. I mean, one other thing that the amendment does is it allows older people to be charged more than they could previously. So under the Affordable Care Act, people who are on the older end of the spectrum can't be charged more than three times higher than people on the younger end of the spectrum for their insurance premiums. This would increase it to five times larger, but also under this MacArthur amendment, it would give states the ability to actually even go higher. But for pre-existing conditions, as far as I'm aware, there's no specific cutoff in terms of how much higher the premium could be. I should mention that increase in premium would only apply to people who didn't maintain continuous coverage, or a lapse in coverage. And yeah, I mean, you know, these high risk pools, who is in them, how much they're going to be funded. A lot of the estimates out there say that there's just not enough money to take care of all these people. And that's my sense as well.
What's your guess on how this gets through the Senate? Can you fathom a guess right now? I know that they've come out and said they're going to take their time. They're going to wait for CBO estimates. They're going to debate this. There are some states, the senators would be very concerned about the cuts to Medicaid. What do you think happens next?
I think the general consensus here is the bill is going to undergo a lot of revision in the Senate. That's the general, you know, what people are saying out there. And I think that's, you know, about right. I mean, there's, you know, a very narrow window to get this through the Senate. They can only, you know, lose a few senators and still pass this. So they have to have everybody basically on board, because we're not expecting a single Democrat to vote for it. And as you said, several of the senators have been very wary about this bill in terms of its effects on Medicaid, in terms of its effect on Planned Parenthood. And then from the right side of the spectrum, you have you know, some concern too from people like Ted Cruz, who was not happy with the at least the original version of the AHCA, feeling that it didn't go far enough. And so you know, I think, I don't know, I think my guess would be this is under that they're going to revise it heavily. And then the question is, will it be something that the House can still swallow? Because again, let's remember, the first version of the AHCA was mostly sunk by the right wing of the Republican Party, who felt that it was too tepid. So is it going to survive? Is the House going to vote on a bill that's much more watered down than what they passed? I don't know. It remains to be seen.
All right, so we only have a couple of minutes left. You talk in your blog today about the single-payer system, that we need to move to a single-payer system. Explain to me what that is. That's what Canada has, right, and how many other countries around the world?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's different varieties of it. I think Canada is probably the closest. Another way to think of it is Medicare. I mean, in many ways, Medicare is a single-payer program, like a single-payer program, but obviously it only applies to people over 65. So the easiest way to explain it is to say that everybody gets Medicare in the country, regardless of how old you are, regardless of your income, everybody gets it. And then we improve Medicare, we get rid of deductibles and copayments. That would be the way I would describe it, the simplest. Universal Medicare for all, improved Medicare for all. And that sounds like, well, can we afford that?
Yeah.
'Cause, you know, it sounds like a lot of money. But the reality is that the experience of other countries has shown us that there's actually huge savings out there, greater efficiencies in a single-payer system. So we believe that we could convert to a single-payer system, and with the money we save, use that money to cover everybody without increasing total health care spending.
Okay. What happens to the insurance companies in that situation? They are out of business?
They are more or less not part of the insurance business. That's right. And that sounds radical, but you know what? We can't go on forever subsidizing the insurance industries just to keep them around. We can do a much better job through a public Medicare-type system than we can with the private insurance industry. So that's going to result in some job losses in particular. We're going to have to come up with ways of retraining people who get displaced from those industries, and that's, you know, a separate issue. But that's right. We're talking about a public, universal system, federal system, like Medicare, but not based on age.
How good is the coverage, though? I was recently in, and I don't know a lot about single payer. I was recently on vacation with my wife, and we met some people from Canada, and we were talking about the election and the universal health care system they have. And they said, while we have that, the actual medical care, they felt, wasn't as good. They said anybody with any money in Canada who has a serious disease ends up in the United States getting treatment. That was their general analogy of it. What's your take on that?
So the idea, so a couple things. I mean, first, you know, I can't speak to the specific, you know, couple that you're speaking of, obviously. But, you know, the evidence of all these Canadians coming, that there's all these Canadians coming to the United States to get health care isn't really there. And think about it this way. Imagine if you can get something for free in Canada, and instead you're going to really come to the United States and spend $30,000 or $50,000 or $100,000 to get it when you can get the equivalent service free in Canada. And you might say, well, if it's your life on the line, maybe you would. But you know what? Canadians live longer and actually have better overall health outcomes. There was just a study recently, Matt, of people with cystic fibrosis, and compared people in the United States to people in Canada with cystic fibrosis, which is a really nasty lung disease. And it found that people in Canada with cystic fibrosis, A, lived 10 years longer, and B, got more transplants, you know, lung transplants, high-tech sort of stuff. So there's anecdotes. People have different stories. I'm not going to not deny that. I'm not going to say that the system's perfect. I'm not going to say that some people haven't had good experiences. But overall, the evidence suggests that it serves people well, that they're happy with it, that they don't want an American-like system. And, you know, it doesn't also – the last thing I'd say is we're not talking about exactly copying a Canadian system. We're talking about taking the best parts of the United States system and combining it with a funding mechanism that seems to work better than the one we have. So we really are talking about taking the best of what we have with the best of international examples have produced and combine that to make a healthcare system that's really the best in the world.
Okay, so what would the funding mechanism be? Just a direct tax that goes into funding a single-payer system? How would the government raise the funds to cover this?
Mm-hmm. So yeah, this is going to be tax-funded. There's different ways to do that. You could have a payroll tax, which is a little more regressive. You could have an income tax, which is more progressive. You could have a combination of the two. One can imagine, and you know, that during a transitional period, we will sort of take all current revenue streams, put them towards a single payer. But ultimately, you replace current funding streams with a tax, and that could probably be a mixture of taxes. And I want to just point out already, though, do you know that we already are almost spending, or all healthcare dollars are almost already coming from public sources. So a majority, in fact, about two-thirds of all healthcare dollars are already coming from public sources. So we're only really talking about replacing a minority of current healthcare spending. And when I say, and you probably say, well, how is it, you know, how is a majority of healthcare dollars already public? Well, if you combine Medicare, if you combine Medicaid, if you combine all the public employees, if you combine the tax breaks that go into employer-sponsored plans, that is an enormous amount of money. And so we're already paying for most of a single-payer system. We just need to get the remaining sliver.
And it is the full belief of you in your heart that if we did it right, it would be better. It would be coverage, not necessarily better coverage than you have now, or your medicine wouldn't necessarily be better, but it would be good coverage, and it could be for all Americans, not leaving 28 million people behind.
That's exactly right. We currently are leaving 28 million behind, and we're leaving more than 28 million behind. You know, like the story you told about the fact that you have this sky-high deductible, you're being left behind. You know, in Canada, they don't have deductibles. There's no co-payments if you go to the doctor or go to the hospital. None. Zip. Zero. Wouldn't it be nice if you could worry about health care and not about bills, not about deductibles, not about co-payments? We don't need this stuff. It's unnecessary. It's a myth that the only way we can afford our health care system is to have you pay through the nose every time you get hospitalized. We don't have to have it. And the reason why you don't have to have it is because most people don't want health care that they don't need. So you can get free hospitalizations because most people are not going to try to get hospitalized just because it's free. And so the system actually works well in other countries where you have universal coverage without having cost sharing or out-of-pocket payments. So yes, in my heart of hearts, I think this would make for a happier society. I think that people will still be sick, obviously. People will still have to deal with very difficult illnesses. But I think that they'll be able to deal with their health problems, not with their medical bills and not with their medical bank. And I think that would make for a much more just healthcare system.
Do you think this could ever even be possible in America, though, with all these insurance companies and their lobbying dollars and the way the Senate and the House works? Do you think this could ever actually get through?
I think the way things are going, it's becoming increasingly likely. I mean, you know, I think Trump Care is going to be a disaster, right? So whether it passes And if it passes, I think people are going to hate it because Trump promised more health care and people are going to get less health care and they're going to say, what the hell is going on here? And if it doesn't pass, it's going to be seen as a failure, as a failed pathway that we're never going to be able to go, you know, we're never going to go down again. And on the other hand, I think people think that the Affordable Care Act is not good enough either, that Obamacare is not good enough. So if Trump care is a disaster, and the ACA, Obamacare, is viewed as insufficient, what's the remaining option, right? I mean, what is it? It's single payer. That's the only other real, real option out there. Charles Krauthammer, the conservative columnist, just today or yesterday was on TV and said that he thinks the way things are going, we're going to have single payer within 7 years. And he's basically saying that people have accepted this sort of premise of healthcare as a right, and once you're on that pathway, it's going to be hard to turn back. Yes, you're right. There are going to be huge impediments, sure. Is the insurance industry going to fight it very hard? Yes. But can we do it? Yes, we can. And the reason is because there's a consensus in the country around the issue of health care. A Gallup poll from last year shows that 58% of the population supports single payer. So if you have the popular support, and if the current options aren't working out, I think this is going to be the option that's left. It's going to be hard to do with this Congress, impossible, some might say, but this government won't be here forever. And when the next government comes around, hopefully they'll be on board.
Well, it'll be interesting. I know you say there's a consensus, there's 58%, but as we see, the popular vote doesn't always win in this country, and it's the people with money and the lobbyists, and, you know, it comes down to 435 people putting things through, 535, and that doesn't always turn out the way you hope. So, Dr. Adam Gaffney, thank you very much for jumping on the phone. It will be interesting to watch, to say the least, how this shakes out over the next few months. Hopefully we can call you again. He is on the board of the Physicians for a National Health Program. That's PNHP.org. You can read his blog at theprogressivephysician.net. Dr. Adam Gaffney, thanks so much for jumping on the phone.
It was a real pleasure. Thank you.
So from Obamacare to Trump care, we'll see what's next. Matt Bubala with you, 720 WGN.